The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Reading today from the August 4th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine, we turn to the main stories and how they were covered. New negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. What happened? President Obama tentatively opened the door to improved U.S.-Iranian relations and a new round of nuclear talks this week, but cautioned that he remained prepared to use military force to prevent Tehran from acquiring a nuclear bomb. The president told the United Nations General Assembly that he would respond to overtures by the recently elected Iranian president Hassan Rouhani, a moderate who has struck a softer tone than his firebrand predecessor, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Obama said he was encouraged by Rouhani's pledge that Iran would never build nuclear weapons, but he said the Iranian leader's conciliatory words will have to be matched by actions that are transparent and verifiable. He instructed Secretary of State John Kerry to begin negotiations with his Iranian counterpart over Tehran's nuclear program. The roadblocks may prove to be too great, but I firmly believe the diplomatic path must be tested, Obama said. A few hours later, Rouhani told the General Assembly that Iran was ready to enter, without delay, into talks over its nuclear program, which he insisted was solely for peaceful purposes. But he declined a White House offer to shake hands with Obama in a prearranged chance meeting, apparently out of concern over how that would be viewed by hardliners at home. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned the U.S. not to be fooled by Rouhani's overtures, saying the Iranian regime wants to talk and play for time in order to advance its ability to achieve nuclear weapons. What the editorial said. This time, Iran might be serious about nuclear negotiations, said the Chicago Tribune. Economic sanctions have caused the country's oil revenues to plummet and inflation to soar. Joblessness has hit young Iranians particularly hard, and they are restless. The regime knows that if it can't persuade the international community to loosen the punishing embargo, it could soon face an Arab Spring-like revolt. The mullahs are only willing to talk because they see an America in retreat, said the Wall Street Journal. They watched with glee as Obama refused to act on his own chemical weapons red line in Syria, accepting a phony Russian diplomatic offer rather than using military force. They're now hoping an eager President Obama will ease sanctions in return for another promise of WMD disarmament, even if Tehran retains the ability to build a nuke at just a few months' notice. What the columnist said. This could be the start of a major breakthrough, said John Judas in NewRepublic.com. A rapprochement between Obama and Rouhani could make a political settlement in Syria a real possibility and ease negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Without the threat of a nuclear Iran, Israel's hardliners would no longer have an excuse for ignoring the West Bank occupation. Hamas, meanwhile, could be pressured by its sponsor, Iran, to accept a two-state solution. You're living in a dream world, said Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. It's Iran's supreme leader, not Rouhani, who will make a final decision on any deal. And no one could mistake Ayatollah Ali Khamenei for a born-again moderate. Just this week, a regime insider told the New York Times that Khamenei will never compromise his basic belief that Iran has a right to control its own nuclear program. Indeed, that program is vital to his regime's survival, said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. Khamenei has seen what happens to Middle Eastern leaders without a nuclear deterrent. Saddam Hussein and Muammar al-Qaddafi, and doesn't want to share their fate. But Obama has no choice but to try to make the best of this diplomatic opening, said Kenneth Pollack in NewRepublic.com. If it fails, and the U.S. uses airstrikes to destroy the regime's nuclear facilities, we will pay a very steep price. Iran will certainly retaliate, and it has ample means to do so, firing missiles at U.S. bases in the Middle East, ordering allies like Hezbollah and Hamas to attack Israel, and sending its highly trained proxies to engage in a wave of terrorist attacks on American soil. We must seize this chance to peacefully resolve one of the greatest problems facing the U.S. and the Middle East. We may not have another. And our second main story, a terrorist massacre at a Kenyan shopping mall. What happened? Militants armed with machine guns, rifles, and hand grenades stormed a shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya this week, slaughtering more than 60 shoppers over a four-day siege and resurrecting the specter of Islamic terrorism in Africa. Between 15 and 20 attackers dressed in black and wearing scarves and turbans entered the upscale Westgate Shopping Mall, which is popular with affluent Kenyans and foreign visitors. The terrorists fanned out through the building, tossing grenades into stores and singling out non-Muslims to shoot at point-blank range, before taking a number of hostages and barricading themselves in a mall supermarket. The Kenyan army landed helicopters on the building's roof and finally retook the mall after 4 days of firefights and explosions, with officials still recovering bodies from under three collapsed floors. At least 61 shoppers were known to be dead, including 18 Western victims, and more than 175 injured. Bodies of children were everywhere, said one survivor, Kamal Kaur. Children, innocent little children, holding on to me asking where their mummies were. The Al-Shabaab group, a Somalia-based partner of Al-Qaeda, claimed responsibility for the attack, saying the killings were a revenge for Kenya's help in toppling Somalia's Islamist regime in 2011. Non-Muslims, the group said, were legitimate targets. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta said 11 suspected terrorists were in custody, and that two or three U.S. citizens may have been among the attackers. Unconfirmed reports said they were teenagers of Somali or Arab origin who had lived in Minnesota. What the editorial said: this attack represents a cold new reality in the global war on terror, said the Dallas Morning News. As the U.S. withdraws from its role as the world's policeman, our allies must keep up the fight against Islamic extremism. But as Kenya just learned, doing so can entail a heavy price. The use of AK-47s to massacre civilians in a mall suggests a worrisome new terrorist strategy, said Newsday. We should consider ourselves warned. Kenya remains united in grief and in courage, said the Standard. Even as we mourn our dead, we are committed to keeping our armed forces in Somalia until that ravaged nation is free of the terrorist threat. Our allies in the U.S., the U.K., and the Middle East must now investigate those in the Somali diaspora who continue to fund and support Al-Shabaab from afar, so that together we can break its back for good. What the columnist said: who are these terrorists? Asked Catherine Zimmerman in the Wall Street Journal. They're not merely a local Somali threat. As many as 50 U.S. citizens have joined al-Shabaab as it switches its focus from regional warfare to a more idealized global fight, with other Islamic terror groups such as al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Al-Shabaab even released a video last month praising three Minnesota martyrs, Americans from Somali communities in the St. Paul region who died waging jihad in Somalia. President Obama may naively insist al-Qaeda is on the run, but its junior partners have the means for a major attack on the U.S. "That's doubtful," said Clinton Watts in foreignpolicy.com. Al-Shabaab's decision to merge with al-Qaeda in 2011 split it into two rival clans, and several of its leaders have defected. This attack may be a last desperate attempt of a dying organization to generate popular support, resources, and personnel. But that weakness makes it more dangerous, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com. A spent force in Somalia, al-Shabaab is now seeking to become a truly transnational terror group. "We're just as vulnerable as Kenya was," said Christopher Dickey in the DailyBeast.com. Al-Qaeda's affiliates no longer need to plan massive, complicated operations like 9/11 when they can terrorize the world with small-scale outrages like Nairobi. It's too easy to imagine those Minnesotan jihadists bringing their guerrilla and terrorist skills back home and attacking the Mall of America or other public gathering places. So as we reconsider our anti-terrorist intelligence activities, Americans should remember that while our war on terror appears to be over, the terrorist global war on us is not. We'll take a look now at the controversy of the week. The GOP. Is the fight to defund Obamacare over? It was a good week for Senator Ted Cruz, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, but a disaster for a bitterly divided Republican Party. With a grandstanding 21-hour talkathon on the Senate floor, Cruz cynically demanded that fellow Republicans join him in an all-out effort to stop Obamacare, denouncing more pragmatic GOP colleagues as the Surrender Caucus. With a Monday deadline looming, Cruz and other Tea Party-backed conservatives are demanding that the Republican-controlled House refuse to pass a budget that would fund the government unless Democrats strip out all monies for the rollout of Obamacare in 2014. But since the White House and the Senate are both controlled by Democrats, there's zero chance the GOP will win. So Cruz's ego-driven, self-righteous last stand had only one real goal: to make him a hero to the base and boost his 2016 presidential ambitions. For Republicans, a government shutdown or a refusal to raise the debt limit 2 weeks later would be a charge into fixed bayonets, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. We've opposed Obamacare from the start, but the GOP's only real way to repeal the law is to win elections. And you don't win elections by throwing foolish tantrums that alienate voters. Taking a principled stand is not a tantrum, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Every Republican in Congress agrees that Obamacare will be a disaster. And the law is also very unpopular with the American people. This is a put-your-money-where-your-mouth-is moment for the GOP. If the only way to demonstrate its opposition is to risk a government shutdown, so be it. Even if we don't win this battle, voters will remember which party heroically tried to stop Obamacare when this boondoggle's consequences kick in. In 2014 and 2016, Democrats will be forced to defend Obamacare in the light of day. If Republicans are so sure Obamacare will be a disaster, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, then why not just let the rollout proceed? What the radical far right really fears is that Americans will discover that the boogeyman conservatives have conjured up is based on lies and distortions, and that extending affordable health coverage to millions of people will prove to be both successful and popular. Once Americans realize that health reform improves on the current broken system, conservatives worry, we'll take a giant leap toward godless socialism. Cruz's motives are even more cynical than that, said Patricia Murphy in the DailyBeast.com. He and his fellow right-wing firebrands know they'll fail to stop Obamacare, but they've purposely whipped the party's Obama-loathing base into a frenzy so they can ask them for fundraising checks. Those millions are pouring in, and Cruz will use them to advance his ambitions. We conservatives need a more realistic and more optimistic strategy, said Avik Roy in NationalReview.com. The argument for shutting down the government over Obamacare assumes, as Cruz has said, that once Americans become addicted to the sugar of subsidized health care, it would mark a permanent and irreversible defeat for the cause of limited government. That's just not true. The passage of Medicare didn't spell the doom of conservatism, nor did the New Deal or any of the last century's expansions of federal bureaucracy. The fight for free market solutions and smaller government will go on. To believe that the extinction of conservatism is upon us unless Obamacare is repealed in the next 100 days is to be a true member of the Surrender Caucus. It was a good week for government intervention after Venezuela's leftist government seized control of a toilet paper factory in an effort to end the nation's ongoing TP shortage. Toilet paper, the government said, is an essential commodity. It was a good week for the power of feminine persuasion after President Obama was caught on a live microphone at the United Nations General Assembly, saying that he quit smoking cigarettes 6 years ago because I'm scared of my wife. It was a good week for the failure to launch after new guidelines adopted by British psychologists define age 25 as the official end of adolescence. The idea that suddenly at 18 you're an adult just doesn't quite ring true, says child psychologist Laverne Antrobus. And it was a bad week for the Houston Astros after the Nielsen Company gave a 0.0 rating to the team's ninth straight loss, indicating that no one in a 20-county area watched the game. The Astros are the worst team in baseball. It was a bad week for cheating after an Italian long-distance runner was allegedly caught trying to pass a drug test using a fake penis filled with someone else's urine. Devis Licciardi, 27, is suspected of using a $140 prosthesis called the Wizinator. It was also a bad week for not following instructions after 66-year-old Gentil Ramirez of Colombia gobbled so much Viagra in an effort to impress his wife that he remained tumescent for several days and had to have surgery to relieve the swelling. Doctor said Ramirez is recovering well. No word on his wife. And here are the best columns from the U.S. The first comes from the Chicago Tribune, author Clarence Page. A campaign based on hysteria. If Obamacare takes effect, the federal government will impose prostate probes and vaginal examinations on young people. It sounds like satire from The Onion, said Clarence Page. But that's the actual fear-mongering message of video ads a conservative group has produced in an all-out last-ditch, by any means necessary push to undermine the health care law. The ads, funded by the conservative billionaire Koch brothers, depict a creepy Uncle Sam snapping on a rubber glove. In the first video, he orders a young man to pull down his pants. In the second, the same leering Uncle Sam ominously takes over a young woman's gynecological exam. Don't let the government play doctor, says the closing message. Why such absurd heights of hysteria? Conservatives fear that once uninsured Americans obtain insurance at reasonable rates, and all Americans find that they can no longer be denied insurance for pre-existing conditions, Obamacare will become popular. So to sabotage the rollout, they're trying to convince young people not to sign up for health insurance and medical care. Here's the hidden message. We hope you're stupid. This comes from Michael Gerson at the Washington Post. When states profit from addiction. We have entered the era of the casino government complex, said Michael Gerson. Facing $6 trillion in debts accrued over decades of fiscal mismanagement, 23 states have partnered with gaming companies to set up networks of small local casinos to suck more money out of the working class and the poor. These new casinos offer no Las Vegas showgirls or glitz and are mostly located in sagging communities desperate for development. Once the locals show up with their money, the goal is to encourage addiction. So slot machines are programmed to feed players a diet of small wins, rewarding them just enough so they keep playing until their money is all gone. In casinos, addiction is the intended result. Studies show that up to 60% of slot machine revenues come from problem gamblers who consistently bet money they can't afford to lose. Perhaps we have given up on government as a source of moral improvement. But should it actively promote addiction and the illusion of sudden wealth without work? If states are that desperate for money, the logical next step is government-run brothels and crack houses. And from Greg Easterbrook, Brook at the Atlantic, the NFL, the richest welfare cheat. The NFL is America's premier sports league, said Greg Easterbrook. So why do the taxpayers so heavily subsidize the billionaires who own the teams? In city after city, the wealthy family owners are given gigantic government subsidies and loan guarantees to build their stadiums, without being required to share one penny of the billions in revenue from ticket sales and TV rights. About 70% of stadium construction costs, in fact, are provided by taxpayers. On top of that outrageous handout, local politicians, dazzled by their association with the glamorous sport and seats in the luxury box, ladle out lavish tax breaks to the teams. The Dallas Cowboys, for example, should be paying Arlington, Texas, at least $6 million a year in property taxes on their massive $1 billion stadium. But we're given a 100% exemption. The entire league is exempt from antitrust laws and operates like a favored industry in Putin's Russia. What this means is that ordinary people are taxed so NFL owners and officers can live as modern feudal lords and ladies. In our free market system, shouldn't a wildly successful league have to stand on its own 2 feet? Our last word article this week is titled, A Better Way of Death. My mother faced death on her own terms, said Katie Butler, and in doing so set a good example for all of us. My mother died shortly before her 85th birthday in a quiet hospital room in Connecticut. One of my brothers was on the phone down the hall, telling me to jump on a plane. We were not a perfect family. She did not die a perfect death. But she avoided what most fear and what many ultimately suffer. Dying plugged into machines in intensive care, or being shocked during a futile cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or dying demented in a nursing home. She died well because she was willing to die too soon rather than too late. Don't get me wrong, my mother, Valerie de la Harpe Butler, loved life. She and my father, Jeffrey, left their South African homeland in their 20s, bursting with immigrant vigor, raised three children, all of whom ultimately moved to California, and built a prosperous life in the U.S. My father became a college professor. My mother, an amateur artist, practiced Japanese calligraphy and served tea at 4 without fail. She got breast cancer in her 40s, and after 2 mastectomies and radiation, she put up her blonde-streaked hair in its classic French twist and returned to the world as a beautiful woman she'd always been. Even as she approached 80, she hiked 2 miles a day, weeded her garden, and stained her own deck. She also spent 6 years as a family caregiver, after my father had a crippling stroke when he was 79 and she was 77. A hastily inserted pacemaker forced his heart to outlive his brain. His medically prolonged dying made her painfully aware of healthcare's default tendency to promote maximum longevity and maximum treatment. It wasn't what she wanted for herself. She was not alone. In California, my home state, a 2012 survey by Lake Research Partners and the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California found that 70% of state residents want to die at home. And national polls have registered even higher proportions. But in fact, nationally, less than a quarter of us do. 2/5 die in a hospital, and a tragic one, 1/5 in intensive care. This is an amazing disconnect in a society that prides itself on freedom of choice. This disconnect has ruinous economic costs. About a quarter of Medicare's $550 billion annual budget pays for medical treatment in the last year of life. And during that time, 1/3 to 1/2 of Medicare's patients spend time in an intensive care unit, where 10 days of futile flailing can cost as much as $323,000. Overtreatment costs the U.S. healthcare system an estimated $158 billion to $226 billion a year. Why don't we die the way we want to die? Because we say we want good deaths, but act as if we won't die at all. Because life-saving technologies have erased the line between saving a life and prolonging a dying. Because saying, "just shoot me," is not a plan. The decisions we make and refuse to make long before we die help determine our pathway to the final reckoning. In the movie Little Big Man, the Indian chief Old Lodge Skin says, as he goes into battle, "Today is a good day to die." My mother lived that way, and it allowed her to claim a version of the good death our ancestors prized. In the early spring of 2009, I discovered that my mother, then 84, could no longer walk far without catching her breath. She had developed 2 perilously stiff and leaky heart valves. In a pounding rainstorm, I drove her to Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, where the surgeon told her that if she survived valve replacement surgery, she could live to be 90. Without it, she had a 50-50 chance of dying within 2 years. My mother weighed the risks of stroke and dementia. Then she said no. Her later cardiologists were disturbed by her decision, and so was I. But I would later discover that people of my mother's age are often like Humpty Dumpty. Seemingly vigorous until a mishap or traumatic surgery sets them on a rapid downward spiral. One of my friends watched her 87-year-old mother die gruesomely after exactly the same surgery my mother rejected. When my mother's heart failure management nurse urged me to get her to reconsider, I called and said, "Are you sure?" "The surgeon said you could live to be 90. "I don't want to live to be 90, she said. "I'm going to miss you," I said, weeping. "You are not only my mother, you are my friend." This was not the world of our ancestors. From the plagues of the Black Death through the 19th century's epidemics of typhoid, childbed fever, and tuberculosis, they helplessly watched people die, from youth to old age. By necessity, they learned how to sit at a deathbed and how to die. That changed in the 1960s, when doctors and inventors in the U.S. and Europe cobbled together astonishing new medical contraptions, using materials first invented or pressed into military service during World War II. Nylon, Dacron, silicone, plastics. Dialysis, open-heart surgery, CPR, the 9/11 system, defibrillators, safer surgical techniques, pacemakers, a whole panoply of life-saving inventions transformed medical practice and all but abolished natural death. Dying moved from the home to the hospital, obliterating Western death rituals and changing the way everyone behaved at the deathbed. Dying was transformed from a spiritual ordeal into a technological flail. Family members were restricted to visiting hours. Often there were no last words because the mouths of the dying were stopped with tubes and their minds sunk into chemical twilights to keep them from tearing out the lines that bound them to earth. Months after an ICU death, family members experience high rates of anxiety, depression, and symptoms of post-traumatic stress. As this technology spread around the world, it transformed the look of the dying body as well. When I first started out washing and coffining corpses early in 1965, the majority of cases were home deaths, wrote the Japanese Buddhist mortician Shinmon Aoki. The bodies looked like dried-up shells. The chrysalis from which the cicada had fled. Along with the economic advances in our country, though, we no longer see these corpses that look like dead trees. He wrote in his memoir, Coffin Man, "The corpses that leave the hospital are all plumped up, both arms blackened painfully by needle marks made at the transfusion, some with catheters and tubes still dangling. This tells us that our medical facilities leave us no room to think of death." In the 1400s, a best-selling how-to book called The Art of Dying offered a road map to the deathbed, framed not as a place of meaningless suffering, but as a transcendent battleground where angels and demons struggled for control of the soul. Family and friends gathered at the bedside and recited prescribed prayers, giving the dying person reassurance, faith, and hope. Because we do not have such pathways now, it's no surprise that relatives often panic and insist that everything be done, even things that are torturous and futile. Any plan seems better than no map at all. That spring, my mother fixed cracked windows in her basement and threw out files for the book my father never finished writing. She told someone she didn't want to leave a mess for her kids. Her chest pain worsened, and her breathlessness grew severe. "I'm aching to garden, to tidy up the neglect of my major achievement," she wrote in her journal. "Without it, the place would be so ordinary and dull. But so it goes. Accept, accept, accept." In July, a new cardiologist suggested inserting an experimental mitral valve replacement, performed by floating the device down a vein. When I mentioned stroke risk, he wrote in his clinical notes, "She was immediately turned off and did not want to pursue further discussion, again desiring only palliative care." That August, she had a heart attack. The next day, I got a call from yet another cardiologist who had been handed my mother's case. They were preparing her for heart bypass surgery and valve replacement, the very surgery she had rejected 5 months before. She seemed to be heading down the grease chute toward a series of Hail Mary surgeries, risky, painful, and harrowing, each one increasing the chance that her death, when it came, would take place in intensive care. I later discovered that the cost of Medicare would probably have been in the $80,000 to $150,000 range. Burning with anger, I told the astonished cardiologist that my mother had rejected surgery when she had a far better chance of surviving it, and I saw no reason to subject her to it now. I later found that in a major study, 13% of patients over 80 who underwent combined valve and bypass surgeries died in the hospital. In a smaller study, 13% died in the hospital, and an additional 40% were discharged to nursing homes. I called my mother in the hospital. I said, "I think we're grasping at straws," she finished my sentence. She was quiet. It's hard to give up hope. 4 hours later, she called back. "I want you to give my sewing machine to a woman who really sews. It's a Bernina. They don't make them like this anymore. They don't make them like this anymore. It's all metal, no plastic parts." "I'm ready to die," she went on. I could barely recognize my stoic and reserved mother. "Cherish Brian," she said, speaking of my long-term partner. "I love Brian. I love Brian for what he's done for you." My mother came home tethered to a portable oxygen tank. She updated her will. A hospice nurse cut off her long white hair. She took digitalis and squirted morphine under her tongue to manage her intense pain, heart pain. She pulled out her Japanese inkstone and calligraphy brushes and brushed out a final one-stroke circle, what the Japanese call an enso. Below it, she wrote, "For my memorial service." I was making flight plans when we talked on the phone for the last time. In an outpouring, I told her how I treasured the memory of her ritual teas and regretted not having picked up more of her domestic elegance. "But Katie," she said, her voice weak, you are good at other things. There isn't much time." That night she was taken to the inpatient hospice unit, with one of my brothers following the ambulance. Once settled into her bed, she took off her hammered silver earrings and said to the nurse, "I want to get rid of all the garbage." Naked she had come into the world, and naked she would return. The next morning she told my brother to call his two siblings in California. By the time he got back, she was dead. He broke into sobs. She died too soon for my taste, but she died the death she chose, not the death anyone else had in mind. Her dying was painful, messy, and imperfect. But that is the uncontrollable nature of dying. I tell you her story that we may begin to create a new art of dying for our biotechnical age. This article comes from Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Plan to a Better Way of Death, by Katie Butler, copyright 2013. Back on the health and science page, the rise of deadly superbacteria. The overuse of antibiotics is causing an alarming increase in drug-resistant bacteria, which now infect more than 2 million Americans a year and kill about 23,000 of them. A new report by Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on the spread of such superbugs makes an urgent case for curbing the use of antibiotics, which create opportunities for resistant bacteria to flourish by killing off their more susceptible competitors. About half of antibiotic use by people in the U.S. is inappropriate, research says, shows. The widespread practice of giving antibiotics to livestock to prevent sickness and promote rapid growth also promotes resistant strains that harm humans. CDC officials have classified three germs as urgent threats: Clostridium difficile, which causes severe diarrhea and kills 14,000 people per year, typically strikes those taking antibiotics to treat other infections. A drug-resistant form of gonorrhea, while less deadly, infects some 820,000 people per year and can cause infertility. Perhaps the most worrisome are the CRE bacteria, which kill half the people they infect, mostly in hospital settings. If we're not careful, we'll be in a post-antibiotic era, CDC Director Thomas Frieden tells the Los Angeles Times. For some patients and some microbes, we're already there. Controlling fracking's leaks. When done right, extracting natural gas through hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, leaks much less methane, a potent greenhouse gas, than previously thought. A new study sponsored by the Environmental Defense Fund and nine oil companies found that fracking wells with state-of-the-art equipment capture 99% of the potential methane emissions. That's significantly better than the 92 to 97% previously estimated by the Environmental Protection Agency. The findings could bolster the argument that even when the release of methane is taken into account, shale gas produces less greenhouse gas than coal. But fracking detractors say the study is fatally flawed because only a select 190 fracking sites were studied, and the companies operating them had advanced knowledge they'd been selected. Another recent study that measured overall air quality in a Utah fracking basin found methane levels 10 to 20 times higher than the new study would predict. I would view this as a best-case scenario for what industry can do to reduce methane emissions when they want to, Cornell University ecologist Bob Howarth tells NPR.org. They do better when they know they are being carefully watched. Shale gas drilling is growing rapidly throughout the U.S., providing 30% of all U.S. natural gas. The health scare of the week: when water can kill. A deadly amoeba that destroys brains has been found for the first time in a treated U.S. water supply. Health officials found the parasite in the drinking water of St. Bernard Parish, Louisiana, after a four-year-old died when he contracted the amoeba while playing on a water slide. The amoeba, Naegleria fowleri, also killed a boy in Miami last month, and an Arkansas girl is recovering after being infected this summer and receiving an aggressive experimental treatment. Naegleria fowleri is common in warm, shallow freshwater, but infections are rare because the amoeba is harmless unless it gets into the nasal passages. Once there, it travels up nerves into the brain, causing swelling that is almost always fatal. In the old days, you would look at your faucet and it wouldn't scare you, Louisiana State epidemiologist Raoult Ratard tells NPR.org. But these days, for some people, it looks menacing. Experts say the best way to prevent an amoeba infection is to wear nose plugs when swimming, avoid splashing in warm, shallow freshwater, and only use distilled water to flush out the sinuses. Never water from the tap. Now over on the talking points. Pope Francis, a new direction for the church. Is the Pope Catholic? Said Candida Moss in the DailyBeast.com. That's what church traditionalists must be anxiously wondering after their new spiritual leader used a lengthy interview last week to question the Vatican's obsession with sexual morality. Expanding on his famous, "Who am I to judge?" line on homosexuality, Pope Francis said the church cannot insist only on issues related to abortion, gay marriage, and the use of contraceptive methods, referring with evident disdain to authoritarian decision-making and small-minded rules. Instead, he said, the church must bring Jesus Christ's mercy to a wounded world and comfort, not condemn, people. He even admitted that church teaching had been mistaken in the past. We must be humble, he said. We grow in the understanding of the truth. No wonder Catholic conservatives are cringing, said William Salatin in Slate.com. On nearly every issue, including sex, the role of women, and economic inequality, Pope Francis is a flaming liberal. Traditionalists can rest easy, said George Weigel in NationalReview.com. Our new pope wants to return the church to its roots in evangelization and conversion. And to win people over, Catholics must first introduce them to the profound beauty of Christ's love. Francis has made it clear that he believes and professes all that the Catholic Church believes to be true about the moral life, including the right to life from conception until natural death, and the proper role of human sexuality. Indeed, days after his interview, he denounced abortion as a symptom of our throwaway culture. Some may find it jarring that Francis is so radically Christ-centered in his emphasis on love and forgiveness. But he won't be making doctrinal changes that would be approved by the editorial board of the New York Times. True, Francis will probably not change actual church doctrine, said John L. Allen, Jr., in the National Catholic Reporter. But for Catholic conservatives, it must now seem powerfully obvious that this isn't their pope. You have to wonder, did the other cardinals know what kind of priest they were voting for? Asked Amy Davidson in NewYorker.com. Francis has spurned the Vatican's elegant trappings, denounced the global economic system for worshiping a god called money, and in his most radical statement said, God reveals himself as history, not as a compendium of abstract truths. In other words, the church must evolve along with history. This looks like an unpredictable moment in Rome. Grand Theft Auto 5. Harmless entertainment? Critics say it's morally suspect, said Nick Gillespie in Time.com. But the immense popularity of Grand Theft Auto 5 has established the video game as the defining popular art form of the 21st century. The latest release in the Grand Theft series, which allows players to roam an enormous, incredibly detailed cityscape, made $800 million on its first day of release last week, more than Hollywood blockbusters make in a year. Today's typical gamer is no longer an acne-ridden male adolescent shut-in. 58% of Americans now play engrossing video games such as Call of Duty and Minecraft, and 45% of gamers are women. Admittedly, Grand Theft V is very violent, with players committing crimes from carjacking to torture to murder. But when novels, movies, and rock and roll were the new art forms, they were also widely condemned for transgressing conventional morality and allowing ordinary people to the thrill of inhabiting other lives and circumstances. Grand Theft V may be brilliant, said Simon Parkin in NewYorker.com, but success doesn't relieve video game makers of all moral responsibility. When we consume violent movies or books, we do so as spectators. But video games ask us to be active, if virtual, participants in the bloodshed. It is you who steals the car, beats up the prostitute, and pulls the trigger. In its torture scene, Grand Theft V even asks players to rotate the gamepad's thumbsticks to tug out the victim's teeth with pliers. But immersing his customers in a fully functioning social universe, a video game's creator does have a moral obligation to the player, who, having been asked to make choices, can be uniquely degraded by the experience. "Oh, lighten up," said Keith Stewart in TheGuardian.com. "There's no clear scientific evidence that playing violent video games leads to violent behavior. When players switch off Grand Theft, they won't become murderous psychopaths, but carry on their lives as functioning adults. As a longtime fan of the Grand Theft series, I wish I could be so sure," said Jesse Singel in BostonGlobe.com. "After yet another mass shooting, I find it disturbing, and no longer funny, to snipe at people from a building's roof or mow down pedestrians with a stolen car. What does it mean that you can simulate a massacre in a pretty realistic way? I don't know, but dismissing an experience this immersive as harmless entertainment isn't giving this powerful medium its due." Food stamps. Why the GOP wants cuts. For Republicans, freedom's just another word for not enough to eat, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. That's the message sent out by the House GOP's vote last week to a $40 billion to axe $40 billion from the federal food stamp program over the next decade, leaving about 3.8 million people to go hungry. Food stamp enrollment has grown since the Great Recession, gutted our economy, but conservatives like Representative Paul Ryan claim the safety net program has become a hammock that lulls able-bodied people to lives of dependency and complacency. Some hammock. Average food stamp benefits are just $4.45 a day, and two-thirds of the program's supposedly lazy beneficiaries are children, seniors, or disabled people. Most of these same Republicans have refused to cut the $20 billion in farm subsidies handed out primarily to giant agribusinesses and wealthy farmers, said Jonathan Chait at nymag.com. Clearly, Republicans are offended only by welfare programs that aid the poor, sick, or otherwise unfortunate. That's real class warfare. The House GOP isn't trying to starve the poor, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, just to rein in an out-of-control program. Washington will spend $83 billion on food stamps this year, more than double the amount in 2008. 1 in 7 Americans now lets taxpayers pay for some or all of their grocery bills. Food stamp rolls have kept expanding even during the economic recovery. The House cuts would be made through common sense reform, said NationalReview.com. Able-bodied people who've been on food stamps for 3 months would have to work or perform community service for 20 hours a week. If that sounds paternalistic, it is. If there's one group of Americans who need a shove in the right direction, it's able-bodied adults who are unable to feed themselves. But these proposed cuts show a total tin ear to American politics, said Henry Olson, also in the NationalReview.com. Mitt Romney lost the race for president largely because he was perceived as not caring about average Americans. Yet here the GOP is once again playing to its Scrooge McDuck stereotype, defending farm subsidies while making a top priority of taking food away from needy people at a time of a tepid job market. When the Democrats kill this dumb bill in the Senate, they'll once again claim to be the party that cares about ordinary families. Why, conservatives? Why? And a few short notes here as we wind down. The number of Americans killed in all the wars since 1775 is 1.17 million, according to the government statistics. The number of Americans killed by firearms, including suicide, since 1968 is 1.38 million. 9 out of 10 Americans throw away perfectly edible, unspoiled food purely because the sell-by or best-before date has expired. The average home throws away $450 worth of edible food a year because of misunderstanding those labels. Amateur marathon runners are slowing down. The median U.S. marathon finish rose 44 minutes from 1980 to 2011. Running experts blame performance-related apathy among millennials who think competing and racing against the clock isn't cool. If the federal government shuts down, 39% of Americans say they will blame Republicans, and 36% will blame President Obama. 57% want Congress to compromise to avoid a shutdown, even if it means passing a budget they disagree with. 33% want legislators to stand by their principles, even if it means a shutdown. 71% of Tea Party Republicans prefer a shutdown to compromise. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.